grieving, and suffering. After a break, it continued the following afternoon when Dexter was rolled down the aisle of his church and parked under his pulpit. Jackie, who'd seen enough, asked that the casket not be opened. Old Man McGargle frowned at this, though he complied and said nothing. He hated to miss such a rich opportunity to see folks racked with grief. For 3 more hours, Jackie and her children stood gamely by the casket and greeted many of the same people they had greeted the evening before. Hundreds showed up, including every able-bodied Methodist in the county and many from other churches, and friends of the family, with a lot of children far too young for such mourning, but drawn to the wake out of friendship with the Bells. Also paying respects were many outright strangers who simply didn't want to miss the opportunity to wedge themselves into the story. The pews were filled with people who waited patiently to proceed past the casket and say something banal to the family. And as they waited, they prayed and whispered softly, passing along the latest news. The sanctuary suffered under the weight of inconsolable loss, which was made even worse by the pipe organ. Miss Emma Faye Riddle churned away, playing one sorrowful dirge after another. Hop watched from a corner of the balcony, vexed again at the strange ways of white folks. After 2 days of these preliminaries, the weary gathered for the last time at the church on Saturday afternoon for the funeral. A preacher friend of Dexter's led the ceremony, which was complete with a full choir, 2 solos, a lengthy homily, more of Miss Emma Faye and her organ, scripture readings, 3 eulogies, tears by the bucket loads, and yes, an open casket. Though he tried valiantly, the preacher failed to make sense of the death. He relied heavily on the theme of God works in mysterious ways, but that found little traction. He finally surrendered, and the choir rose to its feet. After 2 grueling hours, there was nothing left to say, and they loaded Dexter into the hearse and paraded across town to the public cemetery, where he was finally laid to rest amid a sea of flowers and a tide of raw emotion. Long after they were dismissed by the preacher, Jackie and the children sat in their folding chairs under the canopy and stared at the casket and the pile of black dirt beside it. Miss Gloria Grange was a devout Methodist who missed none of the ceremonies, and after the interment, she stopped by the home of Mildred Highlander for tea. Mildred was a Presbyterian and unacquainted with Reverend Bell. Thus, she didn't attend the wake or funeral, but she certainly wanted all the details, and Gloria unloaded. Late Saturday afternoon, Florrie hustled to town also for tea with Mildred. She was eager to hear the details of the suffering caused by her brother, and Mildred was just as eager to pass them along. Chapter 7. For the first time in his young life, Joel Banning disobeyed his father. He left Nashville Saturday morning and took the train to Memphis, a 4-hour ride that allowed plenty of time to consider his act of disobedience. And by the time he arrived in Memphis, he had convinced himself that it was justified. Indeed, he could even articulate his reasons. He needed to check on Florrie to see how she was holding up. He needed to meet with Buford, the overseer, and make sure the harvest was going well. Perhaps he would meet with John Wilbanks and discuss his father's defense, or maybe not. Their little family was disintegrating on all fronts and someone had to step forward and try to save it. Besides, his father was in jail, and if Joel eased in and out the way he planned, his quick visit would not be discovered, his act of disobedience undetected. The train from Memphis to Clanton stopped 6 times, and it was after dark when he stepped onto the platform and pulled his hat low over his eyes. A few people got off, and no one seemed to recognize him. There were 2 cabs in town, and both were idling outside the station, their drivers leaning on the same fender, chewing tobacco and smoking hand-rolled cigarettes. "Is that telephone box still outside the drugstore?" Joel asked the nearest driver.
"It is."
"Can you take me there?"
"Hop in."
The square was packed with late Saturday shoppers. Even during the picking season, the farmers and their field hands cleaned up after lunch and headed to town. The stores were filled, the sidewalks packed. The atrium was showing Bing Crosby in blue skies, and a long line waited around the corner. Live bluegrass was entertaining a throng on the courthouse lawn. Joel preferred to avoid the crowds and asked his driver to stop on a side street. The phone box in front of Gainwright's Pharmacy was occupied. Joel stood beside it, fidgeting for the benefit of the young lady using the phone, and tried his best to avoid eye contact with the packs of people passing by. When he was finally inside, he punched in a nickel and called Aunt Flory. After a few rings, she answered. Assuming, as always, that someone was listening on their rural party line, he said quickly, "Flory, it's me. I'll be there in 20 minutes.
"What? Who?"
"Your favorite nephew."
"Bah."
As the only nephew, he was confident she got the message. Showing up unannounced would give her too much of a shock. Plus, he was starving and figured a little advance notice might get some hot food on the table. Back in the cab, he asked the driver to ease by the Methodist church. As they left the bustling square, they passed Cal's game room, a pool hall known for its bootleg beer and craps in the back. As a young teenager in Clanton, Joel had been strictly warned by his father to stay away from Cal's, in much the same way that all proper young men had been cautioned. It was a rowdy place on weekends, with a rough crowd, and there were usually fights and such. Because it was off-limits, Joel had always been tempted to sneak in during his high school days. His friends would brag about hanging out at Cal's, and there were even stories of girls upstairs. Now, though, with 3 years of college behind him, and in the big city at that, Joel scoffed at the notion of being tempted by such a low-end dive. He knew the fine bars of Nashville and all the pleasures they offered. He could not imagine ever returning to live in Clanton, a town where the beer and liquor were illegal, as were most things. The lights were on in the sanctuary of the Methodist Church, and as they passed it, the driver said,
"You from round here?"
"Not really," Joel said.
"So you haven't heard the big news this week about the preacher?"
"Yeah, I read about it. A strange story."
"Shot him, right there,"
the driver said, pointing to the annex behind the sanctuary.
"Buried him this afternoon. Got the guy in jail, but he won't say anything."
Joel did not respond, did not wish to pursue this conversation that he had not initiated. He gazed at the church as they eased past it, and he remembered with great fondness those Sunday mornings when he and Stella would be dressed in their finest, bow ties and bonnets, and walked into the sanctuary holding hands with their parents, who were also turned out in their Sunday best. Joel knew at a young age that his father's suits and his mother's dresses were a bit nicer than the average Methodists, and their cars and trucks were always newer. And they talked of finishing college and not just high school. He realized a lot as a child, but because he was a Banning, he was also taught humility and the virtue of saying as little as possible. He had been baptized in that church when he was 10 years old, Stella at 9. The family had faithfully attended the weekly services, the fall and spring revivals, the cookouts, potluck suppers, funerals, weddings, and an endless schedule of social events because for them, and for many in their town, the church was the center of society. Joel remembered all of the pastors who had come and gone. Pastor Wardall had buried his grandfather, Jacob Banning. Ron Cooper had baptized Joel, and his son had been Joel's best friend in the fourth grade, and on and on. The pastors came and went until Dexter Bell arrived before the war. Evidently, he stayed too long. Joel said, "Head out Highway 18, I'll show you where to stop." The cabbie replied, "To where? I always like to know where I'm going." "Out by the Bannon place." "You a Bannon?" There was nothing worse than a nosy cab driver. Joel ignored him and glanced through the rear window at the church as it disappeared around the corner. He had liked Dexter Bell, though by his early teens he was beginning to question his harsh sermons. It was Pastor Bell who had sat with the family on that horrible evening when they had been informed that Lieutenant Pete Banning was missing and presumed dead in the Philippines. During those dark days, Pastor Bell took charge of the mourning, directing the church ladies and their endless parade of food, organizing prayer vigils at the church, shooing folks away from the house when privacy was needed, and counseling the family, almost daily it seemed. Joel and Stella even whispered complaints when they grew tired of the counseling. What they wanted was to spend time alone with their mother. But the Reverend was always around. Often he brought his wife Jackie. Other times, he did not. As Joel grew older, he found Jackie Bell cold and aloof, and Stella didn't like her either. Joel closed his eyes and shook his head again. It wasn't really true, was it? His father had murdered Dexter Bell and was now locked up? The cotton began at the edge of town, and under a full moon it was plain to see which fields had been picked. Though he had no plans to farm like his ancestors, Joel checked the market on the Memphis Cotton Exchange every day in the Nashville Tennessean. It was pretty damned important. The land would one day belong to him and to Stella, and the annual harvest would be crucial.
"Gonna be a nice crop this year," the cabbie said.
"That's what I hear. About another mile and I'll get out."
Moments later, Joel said,
"Up there at Pace Road, that'll be fine." "In the middle of nowhere?"
"That's right."
The cab slowed, turned onto a gravel road, and stopped.
"That'll be $1, the driver said.
Joel handed him 4 quarters, thanked him for the lift, and got out with his small duffel. After the cab turned around and was headed back to town, he walked the quarter mile to the driveway leading to his home. The house was dark and unlocked, and as he eased through it, he figured Mac, the blue tick hound, was either at Nineveh's or at Florey's. Otherwise, he would have been barking when Joel approached on the gravel drive. In earlier times, and not that long ago, the house would have been alive with the voices of his parents and music on the radio, and perhaps friends over for dinner on a Saturday night. But tonight, it was a tomb, dark and still, and smelling of stale tobacco. Now, they were both locked away. His mother in a state asylum, his father in the county jail. He left through the rear door, swung wide to avoid the small home of Nineveh and Amos, and picked up the trail by the barns and tractor shed. This was his land, and he knew every inch of it. 100 yards away, a light shone in the window of Buford's cottage. He had been their overseer, or foreman, as he preferred to be called, since before the war, and his importance to the family had just been greatly elevated. All lights were on in Florrie's cottage, and she was waiting near the door. She hugged him at first, then scolded him for coming, then hugged him again. Marietta had made a pot of venison stew 2 days earlier, and it was warming on the stove. A thick, meaty aroma filled the house.
"You're finally gaining some weight,"
Florrie said as they sat at the dining table. She was pouring coffee from a ceramic pot. "Let's not talk about our weight," Joel said.
"Agreed."
Florrie was gaining too, though not on purpose.
"It's so good to see you, Joel."
"It's good to be home, even under these circumstances."
"Why did you come?"
"Because I live here, Aunt Florrie. Because my father is in jail and my poor mother has been sent away. So what the hell is happening to us?"
"Watch your language, college boy."
"Please. I'm 20 years old and I'm a senior. I'll cuss, smoke, and drink anytime I wish."
"Lord have mercy,"
Marietta said as she walked by.
"That's enough, Marietta,"
Florrie snapped. "I'll take care of the stew. You're done for the night. See you late tomorrow morning."
Marietta yanked off her apron, tossed it on the counter, pulled on her coat, and went to the basement. They took deep breaths, sipped their coffee, and let a moment pass. Calmly, Joel asked, "Why did he do it?" Florrie shook her head.
"No one knows but him, and he refuses to explain things. I've seen him once, the day after, and he's in another world."
"There has to be a reason, Aunt Florrie. He would never do something so random, so awful, without a reason."
"Oh, I agree. But he's not going to talk about it, Joel. I've seen the look on his face, seen it many times, and I know what it means. It's a secret he'll take to his grave. He owes us an explanation."
"Well, we're not going to get one, I can promise you that."
"Do you have any bourbon?"
"You're too young for bourbon, Joel."
"I'm 20, he said, standing. "I'll graduate from Vanderbilt next spring, then go to law school."
He was walking to the sofa where he had left his duffel. "And I'm going to law school because I have no plans to become another farmer, regardless of what he wants." He reached into his duffel and retrieved a flask. "I have no plans to live here, Aunt Florrie, and I think you've known that for a long time." He returned to the table, unscrewed the top of the flask, and took a swig. "Jack Daniels. Would you like some?"
"No."
Another swig. "And even if I were considering a return to Ford County, I would say that that possibility has been pretty much shot to hell now that my father has become the most famous murderer in local history." "Can't really blame me, can you?"
"I suppose not. You haven't mentioned law school before."
"I've been thinking about it all year."
"That's wonderful. Where will you go?"
"I'm not sure. Not Vanderbilt. I like Nashville, but I need a change. Maybe Tulane or Texas. I was considering Ole Miss, but now I have this strong desire to get far away from this here."
"Are you hungry?"
"Starving."
Florrie went to the kitchen and filled a large bowl with stew from the pot on the stove. She served it to him with leftover cornbread and a glass of water. Before she sat down, she reached deep into the cupboard and retrieved a bottle of gin. She mixed 2 ounces with a splash of tonic water and sat across from him. He smiled and said, "Stella and I found your gin once. Did you know that?"
"No. Did you drink it?"
"We tried to. I was about 16, and we knew you kept it hidden in the cupboard. I poured a little in a glass and took a sip. I almost puked. It burned to my toes and tasted like hair tonic. How do you drink that stuff?"
"With practice."
"What was Stella's reaction?"
"The same. I don't think she's touched alcohol since."
"I bet she has. You seem to have developed a taste."
"I'm a college boy, Aunt Florrie. It's part of my education."
He took a large spoonful of stew and then another. After 4 or 5, he put down his spoon and paused to allow his food to settle. He helped it with a sip of sour mash, then smiled at his aunt and said,
"I want to talk about my mother, Aunt Florrie. There are secrets back there, and you know a lot that you haven't told us."
Florrie shook her head and looked away. He went on, "I know she broke down when they told us he was dead, or presumed dead. Hell, didn't we all, Aunt Florrie? I couldn't leave the house for a week. Remember that?"
"How could I forget? It was awful."
"We were like ghosts, just sleepwalking through the days and dreading the nights. But we somehow found a little strength to go on. And I think Mom did okay, don't you? Didn't Mom sort of get tough and put on a brave face?"
"She did. We all did. But it wasn't easy."
"No, it wasn't. It was a living hell, but we survived. I was at Vanderbilt when she called that night with the news that he wasn't dead after all, that he'd been found and rescued. They said he was badly wounded, but that didn't seem important. He was alive. I hurried home and we celebrated, and I remember Mom being quite happy. Am I right, Aunt Florrie?"
"Yes, that's the way I remember it. We were elated, almost euphoric. And that lasted for a few days. Just the fact that he was alive was a miracle. Then we began reading stories about how badly the POWs were treated over there, and we worried about his injuries and so on."
"Sure. Now back to my mother. We were thrilled when he was released. And when he came home a hero, my mother was the proudest woman in the world. They could not have been happier. Hell, we were all ecstatic. And that was only a year ago, Aunt Florrie.
So, what happened?"
"Don't assume I know what happened, because I don't. For the first few weeks, all was well. Pete was still recovering and getting stronger by the day. They were happy. Things seemed to be fine. Then they weren't. I was not aware of their troubles until long after they had started. Nineveh told Marietta that they were fighting, that Liza was acting crazy, prone to long bouts of foul moods, and time alone in her room. They stopped sleeping together, and your father moved into your bedroom. I wasn't supposed to know this, so I couldn't really ask. And you know it's a waste of time to ask your father anything about his private matters. I've never been close to Liza, and she would never confide in me, so I was in the dark. And frankly, that's not always a bad place to be."
A long pull on the whiskey, and Joel said, "Then she was sent away."
"Then she was sent away. Why, Aunt Florrie? Why was my mother committed to the state mental hospital?"
Florrie sloshed her gin around her glass and studied it at length. Then she took a sip, grimaced as if it was awful, and set down the glass.
"Your father decided she needed help, and there's no one around here. The professionals are at Whitfield, and that's where he sent her."
"Just like that, she got shipped off?"
"No, there were proceedings. But let's be honest, Joel,
Your father knows the right people, and he's got the Wilbanks boys in his back pocket. They talked to a judge, he signed the order, and your mother acquiesced. She did not object to the commitment order, not that she had a choice. If Pete insisted, which I'm sure he did, she could not fight him.
What's her diagnosis?
I have no idea. Being a woman, I guess. Keep in mind, Joel, that it's a man's world. And if a husband with connections feels as though his wife is suffering through the change and depressed and her moods are swinging right and left, well, he can send her off for a spell.
I find it hard to believe that my father would have my mother committed to a mental institution because of the change. She seems kind of young for that. There's a lot more to it, Aunt Flory.
I'm sure there is, but I was not privy to their discussions and conflicts.
Joel returned to his stew and gulped a few bites, followed with more of his whiskey. In a futile effort to change the subject, Flory asked,
"Are you still seeing that girl?"
"Which girl?"
"Well, I guess that's enough of an answer. Any girl in your life these days?"
"Not really. I'm too young and I have law school in front of me." "You said on the phone that you've spoken with John Wilbanks. I assume he's taken charge of the defense."
"He has, or what there is of it. Your father is not cooperating. Wilbanks wants to use an insanity defense. Says it's the only way to save his life, but your father will have none of it. Says he's got more sense than Wilbanks or the next lawyer, which I won't argue."
"More proof that he's crazy.
He has no choice but to plead insanity. There's no other defense. I did the research myself at the law school yesterday." "Then you can help Wilbanks. He needs it."
"I've written him a letter, and I thought about seeing him tomorrow."
"That's a bad idea, Joel. I doubt he works on Sundays, and you cannot be seen around town. Your father would be upset if he knew you were here. My advice to you is to leave town as quietly as you sneaked in and not to return until Pete says so."
"I'd like to talk to Buford and check on the crops."
"You can't do a thing to help with the crops. You're not a farmer, remember? Besides, Buford has things under control. He reports to me. I plan to run by the jail and report to Pete. We're in the midst of a good harvest, so don't try to screw things up. Besides, Buford would tell your father that you're here. Bad idea."
Joel managed a laugh, his first, and swigged his whiskey. He shoved his bowl away, which prompted her to say,
"Half a bowl? You should eat more, Joel. You're finally filling out, but you have a ways to go. You're still too thin."
"Not much of an appetite these days, Aunt Flory, for some reason." "Mind if I smoke?" She nodded and said,
"On the porch."
Joel stepped outside with a cigarette while she cleared the table. Then she refreshed her drink, laid another log on the fire in the den, and fell into her favorite armchair to wait for him. When he returned, he grabbed his flask, joined her in the den, and sat on the worn leather sofa. She cleared her throat and said,
"There's something you should know since we were discussing the cotton. I suppose it's no real secret since there is a public record of it in the courthouse. About a month ago, your father hired a lawyer in Tupelo to write a deed transferring ownership of his farm to you and Stella jointly. My land, of course, belongs to me and was not involved. John Wilbanks told me this last Wednesday in his office. Of course, you and Stella would one day inherit the land anyway."
Joel thought for a moment, obviously surprised and confused.
"And why did he do this?" "Why does Pete do anything? Because he can. It wasn't very smart, according to Wilbanks. He was moving his assets to protect them from the family of a man he was planning to murder. Plain and simple. In doing so, though, he handed a gift to the prosecution. The DA can prove at trial that the murder was premeditated. Pete planned everything.
Is the land protected?
Wilbanks doesn't think so, but we didn't go into it. It was the day after, and we were still stunned. Still are, I guess.
Aren't we all?
Wilbanks thinks Bell's family will come after the land?
He implied that, but didn't say it outright. It might be fodder for your research now that you've found the law library.
This family needs a full-time lawyer. He took a drink and finished his flask. Florrie watched him carefully and loved every ounce of his being. He favored her side, the Bannings, tall with dark eyes and thick hair, while Stella was the image of Liza, both in looks and in temperament. He was grieving, and Florrie ached with his pain. His happy, privileged life was taking a dramatic turn for the worse, and he could do nothing to correct its course. Quietly, he asked, "Has anyone talked about Mom getting out? Is it even a possibility? Dad sent her away, and now that his influence is rather limited, is there a chance she can come home?"
"I don't know, Joel, but I've heard nothing about that. Before this, your father would drive to Whitfield once a month to see her. He never said much, but on a couple of occasions he mentioned his visits, said she was not getting any better."
"How is one supposed to improve in an insane asylum?"
"You asking the wrong person."
"And why can't I visit her?"
"Because your father said no. I can't see my father, and I can't visit my mother. Is it okay to admit that I miss my parents, Florrie?"
"Of course you do, dear. I'm so sorry."
They watched the fire for a long time, and nothing was said. It hissed and crackled and began dying for the night. One of the cats jumped up onto the leather sofa and looked at Joel as if he were trespassing. Finally, Joel said softly, "I don't know what to do, Florrie. Nothing makes sense right now." For the first time, his words were not clear, his tongue thick. She took a sip and said,
"Well, coming home tonight is not the answer. The train from Memphis leaves at 9:30 in the morning, and you'll be on it. There's nothing to do here but worry."
"I suppose I can worry at college."
"I suppose you can."
Chapter 8. The Ford County Grand Jury convened on the third Monday of each month to listen to evidence of the latest crimes among the locals. On the docket for October 21st was the usual laundry list: a domestic dispute that devolved into a severe beating, Chuck Manley and his alleged stolen car, a Negro who fired a pistol at another, and though he missed, the bullet shattered the window of a rural white church, which added gravity to the incident and elevated it to a felony, a con man from Tupelo who had blanketed the county with bad checks, a white man and a black woman who were caught in the act of enthusiastically violating the state's anti-miscegenation laws, and so on. The list totaled 10 crimes, all felonies, and that was about average for a peaceful community. Last on the list was the matter of Pete Banning and his murder charge. Miles Truitt had been the district attorney since his election 7 years earlier. As the chief prosecutor, he handled the grand jury, which was little more than a rubber stamp for whatever he wanted. Truitt selected the 18 people who served, picked which crimes needed to be pursued, called witnesses who gave evidence that favored only the prosecution, leaned heavily on the jury when the evidence seemed a bit shaky, and secured the indictments that were then served upon the defendants. After that, Truitt controlled the criminal trial docket and decided which cases would be tried first and last. Almost none actually went to trial. Instead, they were settled with a deal, a plea bargain in which the defendant confessed to being guilty in return for as light a sentence as possible. After 7 years of routine prosecutions, Miles Truitt had been lulled into the mundane rut of putting away bootleggers, wife beaters, and car thieves. His jurisdiction covered the five counties of the 22nd District, and the year before, he had tried only four cases to verdicts. All other indictees had pled out. His job had lost its luster, primarily because there simply was not enough exciting crime in his corner of northern Mississippi. But Pete Banning had broken the monotony, and in spectacular fashion. Every prosecutor dreams of the sensational murder trial with a prominent white defendant, a well-known victim, a crowded courtroom, lots of press, and of course, an outcome favorable to the prosecutor and all the fine citizens who voted for him. Truitt's dream was coming true, and he tried to control his eagerness to get on with the prosecution of Pete Banning. The grand jury assembled in the courthouse in the same room used by trial juries. It was a cramped space, hardly wide and long enough for a trial jury of 12, with chairs wedged along a long, narrow table. Of the 18, only 16 were present, all white men. Mr. Jock Fettison from Caraway had called in sick, though it was widely believed he was really too busy in his cotton fields to be bothered with trifling judicial matters. Mr. Wade Burrell had not bothered to call at all and had been neither seen nor heard from in weeks. He was not a farmer, but was rumored to be having trouble with his wife. She said flatly that the bum had gone off drunk and wasn't coming back. 16 was a sufficient quorum, and Truitt called them to order. Sheriff Gridley was brought in as the first witness and sworn to tell the truth. Truitt began with Chuck Manley's case, and Gridley laid out the facts. The vote was 16-0 in favor of an indictment for grand larceny with no discussion. The bad check artist was next, and the sheriff presented copies of the checks and affidavits from some of the aggrieved merchants, 16-0 again, and the same for the pulpwood cutter who broke his wife's nose, among other injuries. Justice was sailing right along until Truitt called up the miscegenation case. The two lovers had been caught in the act in the back of a pickup truck, parked in an area known for such activities. Deputy Roy Lester had received an anonymous tip by phone that the two were planning such a rendezvous, and he got there first. The identity of the tipster was unknown. Lester hid in the darkness and was pleased to learn that the tip was accurate. The white man, who later admitted to having a wife and a kid, drove his truck to a spot very near Lester's hiding place and commenced to partially undress while the black girl, aged 18 and single, did likewise. The area being deserted at that moment, they decided to get down to business in the back of the truck. Testifying before the grand jury, Lester claimed he watched calmly from behind some trees. In truth, though, he found the encounter quite erotic and was anything but calm. The grand jurors hung on every word, and Lester was discreet, even understated, with his descriptions. As the white man was reaching his climax, Lester jumped from his hiding place, brandished his weapon, and yelled, "Stop right there!" Which was probably the wrong command, because who could really stop at that critical juncture? As they hurriedly dressed, Lester waited with the handcuffs. He walked them to his patrol car hidden down a dirt trail and hauled them to jail. Along the way, the white man began crying and begging for mercy. His wife would certainly divorce him, and he loved her so. When he finished his testimony, the room was silent, as if the grand jurors were lost in their own imaginations and wanted more of the narrative. Finally, Mr. Phil Hobard, a science teacher at Clanton High and a transplanted Yankee from Ohio, asked, "If he's 26 years old and she's 18, then why is having relations against the law?" Truett was quick to take control of the discussion.
"Because sex between a Caucasian and a Negro is against the law. And it's against the law because the state legislature made it illegal many years ago."
Mr. Hobard was not satisfied. He ignored the frowns from his colleagues and pressed on. "Is adultery against the law?" A few of the men dropped their stares and glanced at some papers on the table. Two even squirmed, but the zealots looked even fiercer, as if to say, "If it's not, it certainly should be." Truett replied,
"No, it is not. At one time it was, but the authorities found it rather difficult to enforce."
Hobard said, "So let me get this straight. In Mississippi today, it's not against the law to have sex with a woman who's not your wife, so long as she's of the same race. A different race, though, and you can be arrested and prosecuted, right?"
"That's what the code says," Truett answered.
Hobard, who was evidently the only one on the grand jury with the courage to dig deeper, asked, "Don't we have better things to do than to prosecute two consenting adults who were evidently having a lot of fun in bed or in the back of a truck or wherever?"
Truett replied, "I didn't write the law, Mr. Hobart. And if you want to change it, then take up the matter with your state senator."
"Our state senator is an idiot."
"Well, perhaps, but that's outside the scope of our jurisdiction. Are we ready to vote on this indictment?" Truett asked.
"No," Hobart said sharply. "You're trying to speed things along. Fine. But before we vote, I'd like to ask my colleagues on this grand jury, how many of them have ever had sex with a black woman? If you have, then there's no way you can vote to convict these two people." An unseen vacuum sucked all the air out of the room. Several of the grand jurors turned pale. Several turned red with anger. One zealot blurted,
"Neville!"
Others spoke,
"Come on, this is ridiculous. You're nuts. Come on, let's vote. It's a crime, and we have no choice."
Nix Gridley stood in a corner, looked at their faces, and managed to conceal a smile. Dunn Ludlow was a regular at the Colored Whorehouse in Lowtown. Milt Munsey had kept the same black mistress for at least as long as Nix had been sheriff. Neville Ray came from an old family of plantation owners who had been mixing and mingling for generations. Now, though, all 15 were posturing in various awkward stages of piousness. The state's anti-miscegenation law was similar to others throughout the South and had little to do with sex between white men and black women. Such relations were hardly frowned on. The purpose of the law was to protect the sanctity of white women and keep the Negroes away from them. But as history had proven many times, if two people want to have sex, they do not spend time thinking about code sections. The law prevented nothing, but was used occasionally as punishment after the fact. Truett waited until all comments ceased, then said,
"We need to move along. Can we have a vote here? All in favor of these two being indicted, raise your hands."
15 hands went up, all but Hobart's. An indictment did not require a unanimous vote, 2/3 would suffice, and Truett had never lost one. The grand jury soon dispatched with the other cases, and Truett said, "And now we come to the matter of Mr. Pete Banning. First-degree murder. I'm sure you all know as much as I do, Sheriff Gridley." Nick stepped over some boots and shoes and managed to return to the seat at the end of the table. Half the men were smoking, and Nick told Roy Lester to crack a window. Truett lit a cigarette and blew smoke at the ceiling. Nick began with the crime scene and passed around two photos of Dexter Bell lying dead in his office. He described the scene, recounted the testimony of Hop Perdue, and told the story of driving out to arrest Pete, who told him where to find the gun. Nix produced the gun and three slugs and said there was no doubt they did the damage. The state police had sent a report. Since his arrest, Pete Banning had refused to discuss the case. He was represented by Mr. John Wilbanks. If indicted, it appeared as though there would be a trial in the near future.
"Thank you, Sheriff," Truett said. "Any questions?"
A hand shot up, and Milt Muncy asked loudly,
"Do we have to vote on this? I mean, I know Pete Banning, and I knew Dexter Bell, and I really don't want to get involved here."
"Neither do I," said Tyus Sutton. "I grew up with Pete Banning, and I don't feel right sitting in judgment."
"That's right," said Paul Carlin. "I'm not touching this case, and if you try to force me, then I'll just resign." "We can resign from this grand jury, can't we? I'd rather resign than deal with it."
"No, you can't resign," Truett said sharply, as his rubber stamp unraveled.
"How about we abstain?" asked Joe Fisher. "It makes sense that we have the right to abstain in a case where we are personally acquainted with those involved, right? Show me where in the law it says we can't abstain when we want to."
All eyes were on Truett, who in matters of grand jury procedure usually made up the rules as he went along, as did all DAs around the state. He could not remember any reference to abstentions in these situations, though truthfully, he had not looked at the code sections in years. He had become so accustomed to the rubber stamp approach that he had neglected the procedural intricacies. As he stalled and tried to think of a response, his thoughts were not on the grand jury, but on the trial jury. If the men of Ford County were so split and so eager to avoid the case, how could he possibly convince 12 of them to return a verdict of guilty? The biggest case of his career was melting before his eyes. He cleared his throat and said,
"May I remind you that you took an oath to properly and without bias listen to the evidence and decide if in all probability the alleged crime was committed. You are not here to pass judgment on Mr. Banning's guilt or innocence. That's not your job. Your duty is to decide whether he should be charged with murder. The trial court will determine his fate. Now, Sheriff Gridley, do you have any doubt that Pete Banning murdered Dexter Bell?"
"None whatsoever."
"And that, gentlemen, is all that is sufficient for an indictment. Any further discussion?"
"I ain't voting," Tyus Sutton said defiantly. "Pete had a reason for doing what he did, and I ain't passing judgment."
"You're not passing judgment," Truett snapped. "And if he had a reason and has a legal defense, it will all come out at trial. Anybody else?"
Truett was angry and glared at his jurors as if ready for a brawl. He knew the law, and they didn't. Tyus Sutton was not easily intimidated. He stood and pointed a finger across the table at Truett.
"I'm at a point in my life where I will not be yelled at. I'm leaving, and if you want to tattle to the judge and get me in trouble, I'll remember that the next time you run for office. And I know where to find a lawyer."
He stomped to the door, opened it, walked through it,
and slammed it behind him.
Down to 15. Two-thirds were required for an indictment, and at least three of those remaining didn't want to vote. Truett was suddenly sweating and breathing heavily, and he was racking his brain as he strategized on the fly. He could dismiss them and present the Bannon case next month. He could dismiss them and ask the judge for a new panel. He could press for a vote, hope for the best, and if he failed to get 10, he could always present the case again in November. Or could he? Did double jeopardy apply to grand jury cases? He didn't think so, but what if he made the wrong move? He had never been in such a position. He decided to press on as if he'd been in this situation many times. Any more discussion? There were some anxious glances around the table, but no one seemed eager to join Tyus Sutton.
Very well, Truett continued. All those in favor of indicting Pete Bannon for the first-degree murder of the Reverend Dexter Bell, raise your hands.
With no enthusiasm, five hands slowly went up. Five more eventually joined them. All others remained under the table.
You can't abstain, Truett snapped at Milt Muncy.
And you can't make me vote,
Muncy shot back angrily, ready to either throw a punch or take one. Truett looked around the room, counted quickly, and announced,
I count 10. That's two-thirds, enough for an indictment. Thank you, Sheriff. We are dismissed.
As the days passed, Pete busied himself by improving conditions at the jail. The coffee was his first target, and by the end of his third day, the entire jail, prisoners, guards, and cops, were drinking standard coffee from New Orleans. Flory delivered it in 5-pound bags, and during her second visit, asked Nix what the colored prisoners were drinking. He replied that they were not served coffee, and this angered her. During the ensuing tirade, she threatened to withhold all coffee until it was offered to everyone. At home, she snapped Marietta and Nineveh into high gear, and they began cooking and baking with a vengeance. Almost daily, Flory arrived at the jail with cakes, pies, cookies, brownies, and pots of beef stew, venison stew, collard greens, red beans and rice, and peas and cornbread. The quality of the jailhouse cuisine rose dramatically for all inmates, with most of them eating far better than on the outside. When Amos gutted a fatted hog, the entire jail gorged on smoked spare ribs. Nix and his boys feasted as well and saved a few bucks on lunch. He had never experienced the incarceration of a wealthy landowner who had plenty of acreage for growing food and the staff to prepare it. After the first week, Pete convinced Nix to appoint him a jail trustee, which meant his cell was not locked during the day and he could roam as he pleased as long as he did not leave the building. Nix was somewhat sensitive to the potential rumors that Pete was getting special treatment and at first didn't like the idea of using him as a trustee. But every respectable jail had at least one trustee, and at the moment, Nix had none. The last one, Homer Gallix, served the county faithfully for 6 years and had 3 to go on his aggravated assault conviction when he ran off with a widow who was rumored to have some money. They had not been seen since, and Nix had neither the time, the interest, nor the energy to look for them. Another rule, one that was evidently non-binding as well, was that a trustee had to first be convicted of his crime and sentenced to serve his time in the county jail rather than the state pen. Nix brushed this aside as well, and Pete became the trustee. As such, he served the much-improved meals to the other 4 white prisoners and to the 6 or 7 black ones on the backside of the jail. Since all prisoners soon knew where the food was originating, Pete was a popular trustee. He organized work details to clean up the jail, and he paid for a plumber to modernize the equipment in both restrooms. For a few bucks, he devised a venting system to clear the smoke-clogged air, and everyone, even the smokers, breathed easier. He and a black prisoner overhauled the furnace, and the cells were almost toasty at night. He slept hard, napped frequently, exercised on the hour, and encouraged his new pals to do likewise. When he was bored, he read novels, almost as fast as Flory could deliver them. There were no shelves in his tiny cell, so she hauled them back to his study, where his library numbered in the thousands. He also read stacks of newspapers and magazines that she brought him. Pete offered his reading materials to the others, but there was little interest. He suspected they were either fully or partially illiterate. To pass the time, he played poker with Leon Colliver, the moonshiner across the hall. Leon was not particularly bright, but he was sharp as hell at cards, and Pete, who had mastered all card games in the army, had his hands full. Cribbage was his favorite, and Flory brought his cribbage board. Leon had never heard of the game, but absorbed it with no effort, and within an hour was up a nickel. They played for a penny a game. IOUs were acceptable, and no one really expected to collect any money. Late in the afternoon, after all chores were done and the jail was spiffier than ever, Pete would unlock Leon's cell, and they would move their rickety chairs into the hallway, completely blocking it. The cribbage board was placed on a small square of plywood Pete kept in his cell. It was balanced on a wooden barrel that once held nails. The games began. Leon managed to keep a flask full of corn whiskey, distilled, of course, by his family, and at first Pete showed no interest. However, as the days dragged on and he began to accept the reality that he would be either executed or sent to prison forever, he said, "What the hell?" In the heat of a tense cribbage game, Leon would glance around, up and down the hall, remove the flask from his front pants pocket, unscrew the top, take a swig, and hand it over. Pete would look around, take a drink, and hand it back. They weren't selfish. There simply wasn't enough to go around. And besides, every jail had a snitch, and Sheriff Gridley would frown on the drinking. The two were hunched over the game board, talking of nothing but the score, when the door opened and Nix entered the narrow hallway. He was holding some papers.
"Evening, fellas," he said.
They nodded politely. He handed the papers to Pete and said,
"The grand jury met today, and here's your indictment. First degree."
Pete sat straight and took the papers.
"No real surprise, I guess. It was pretty cut and dried. Trial set for January 6th.
"They can't do it any sooner?"
"You'll have to talk to your lawyer about that."
Nix turned around and left. Chapter 9. A month after the death of her husband, Jackie Bell moved with her three children to her parents' home in Rome, Georgia. She took the few meager pieces of furniture that didn't belong to the parsonage. She took a flood of beautiful memories of the past 5 years in Clanton. She took the painful farewells of a congregation that had nurtured her and her family. And she took her husband. In the chaos after his murder, she had agreed to have him interred in Clanton because it was simpler. However, they were not from Mississippi, had no relatives there, and no real roots, and she wanted to go home. Why leave him behind? Part of her day was a trip to the cemetery to lay flowers and have a good cry, a ritual she planned to continue forever, and she couldn't do that from Georgia. Dexter was from Rome, too, so she had him reburied in a small cemetery behind a Methodist church. They had married when he was in seminary in Atlanta. Their nomadic journey began upon graduation, when he was assigned the position